Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to another Tech Talk episode of The Yield. It's great to have you here. I do want to welcome everyone to another installment of our podcast. For our webinar, do check us out at yieldstreet.com. We have a bunch of open offerings and new ones launching every week. If you are an originator, do check out our Raise Capital page. There's a link in the footer, or you can just email us at originations@yieldstreet.com, and we would be happy to help. With that, I'm absolutely honored to welcome our first live guest in our studio today, Emilia Sharifova, the Chief Information and Innovation Officer at KKR, and an old friend. So welcome, Emilia.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. It's so great to have you. And we're going to spend the next 45 minutes just chatting about our journey through fintech and some of the things that we're seeing in big and small institutions. Emilia has a unique perspective, having been both in startups and big institutions. So it'll be just a fun chat as usual, hopefully a fun and entertaining one for everyone. And do send us questions. We will get to as many as we can over the next 40 to 45 minutes. And with that, Emilia, we would love to know a little bit about your journey to being to where you are today. I know you have a background and a degree in journalism, and that trajectory from that journalism background in Colombia to being the CTO of, you know, a tiny little place called KKR is a fascinating story for me, and I'm sure for all of our listeners and viewers as well. So
yeah, absolutely. More. Happy to share. Like many of my friends who came to the United States to study and to catch the bigger dream, I grew up during the height of the Soviet Union and always had very big interest in social justice and traveling the world, because by nature of my sort of background, the country was very closed country. And there was always a dream to get out, to experience freedom, and maybe to tell the stories of freedom and relay the stories of freedom to the rest of the world. So I used to listen to the BBC and Voice of America, and hoping one day to actually speak to Native American or English speakers and learn about the world. And so as part of that, I wanted to be a journalist and was deeply interested in social justice and human rights. And I thought that would be my platform to do that. So I got an opportunity to come to the United States on a full scholarship, and was very excited to pursue my journalism degree. I graduated and came to New York, and my first job was at the American Civil Liberties Union, which was, again, kind of where my passion lied, with social justice, civil liberties, human rights. I was very lucky. I do not want to date myself, but it was right at the beginning of the internet. And ACLU actually was one of the first nonprofits that had an AOL page. It was an AOL Freedom page.
Wow.
Web page.
I did not know that.
Yes. And so that's how my interest in web development and software development started, because it started as just trying to do, trying to take initiative and be better at my job. I was in public affairs department and doing research, but very quickly realized that if I were to get a job and potentially sponsored in this country, I probably should pursue a technical technical path. So I started taking classes, C programming, Perl.
Old school.
Totally old school. Brian Kernighan's
Bible.
That's right. I still have it on my desk.
Me too. I have my copy from grad school still on my shelf.
Awesome. Yeah. It's hard not to love it. The simplicity of language and elegance in that book. So yes, that was the beginning.
Did you get any exposure to computers in any way at all while you were still in Soviet Union?
Yes, I did. I actually grew up in a very engineering focused family. My dad was a kind of industrial designer, building interesting things in a military plant that was not on a map. And all of my aunts were engineers.
So you grew up in a tech. So that's
where, yes.
I grew up in a family of writers and booksellers. So my exposure to tech was in dribs and drabs over the 80s. And finally, when I was an undergrad, I never had a computer growing up. Like, I don't think very few people except the kind of wealthier section of the population in India actually owned a computer, right? So that's amazing that, like, how despite somewhat similar backgrounds, it's still like, you know, how the exposure to tech is so varied.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know there was a big friendship in the Soviet times between India and Russia. And as you know, I know quite a few.
Yeah, we learned about it in history books.
Yes. So yes, that's how, you know, it was actually by chance. And that's why, you know, when kids who are graduating from college ask me, like, what's the biggest advice I give them? I like to tell them, be curious. You know, I think curiosity and, you know, and that's what I try to foster in my own teams is culture of learning and curiosity. And I think it can take you lots of different places.
So how did your segue from tech in general and web development to fintech, which is a particularly interesting area of tech?
Yes.
How did that happen? Because you're the CTO of PulsePoint at one point.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I think in many ways you're also a big reason why I ended up there. But I can say that one of my early jobs was actually being one of the early tech employees at a financial services organization that was sort of operating like a top U.S. trading venue for over-the-counter securities. Right. And also interesting to see the evolution of markets. You know, what we're seeing right now in alternative asset management, a similar evolution that took place in equities.
Yeah.
You know, in equities probably in the 80s, then over-the-counter securities in the aughts. And now we're seeing this in the alternative assets. Yes.
Yeah, I guess like, you know, people like E-Trade, of course, and Schwab. Early pioneers of
absolutely.
So now we have like high frequency trading, all these like super powerful machines and algorithms that do that. But you were doing this when big data and the ability to crunch through large amounts of data was not that easy, especially not possible on commoditized hardware.
How was
that whole thing at PulsePoint? Like, how did you?
Yes. Not only at PulsePoint, but even previous. So it was great to see the evolution of, you know, starting from literally it was a telephonic marketplace. The company that I joined, it was like where you pick up a phone and you get the price for a security, and then that's how you trade. And by the way, again, and there's still quite a few markets like this still in existence, and they still have
my mind. It's like a notch above how Reuters started back in the 1800s, where they had carrier pigeons ferrying stock quotes tickers across point to point. And like now in this day and age of high speed internet, even phone calls seem not that distant from carrier pigeons.
Absolutely. But it was, to me, I think what's amazing is even in my tenure at OTC Markets, starting from building very basic trading engines all the way to building a large scale, low latency, massive market data feeds and having low latency trading firms like Jane Street and E-Trade connect. And so going from having to do some really nifty things on the low level kind of programming, and that's where my C background comes in handy.
Write some nice embedded software for
totally. Totally. But now, you know, you've got so much more to play with without a lot of effort.
And in many ways, I think like the way we kind of like you and I from a career standpoint, we kind of grew up along with the internet.
So
seeing that evolution, like going through like work, well, I remember a point where a 56.6K modem was like oh my God, that's fast. And now if we get 20 megabits per second symmetric and we think that's slow.
Yes.
And that happened over such a short period of time,
Absolutely.
Which is kind of like amazing to be witness to that.
Yes. So yeah, I can add to that. And so I think again, seeing the marketplace evolve, mm-hmm. even the place where I was starting my career at, and I was always curious about, as now looking back, I realize like what financial services have to offer versus, and we'll talk a little bit more about it in details, versus what startups have to offer. But I have to say, working for a regulated marketplace, mm-hmm. there's a certain level of discipline that's required. And so that brings a certain level of rigor, and that brings a certain level of engineering, I think, excellence that sometimes you may not have when you're not regulated and you have to move fast and break things.
Yeah, that's it's an interesting motto.
Yeah,
it worked for Facebook, actually, not even for them. But
yeah.
for us, it's always like you and I, or whether it's LearnVest or Kiko, it's always like move as fast as you can without breaking things.
Right,
that's the only thing we can do. That's amazing.
Yes. So I was always interested, and I think again, sort of my curiosity got me here. I was always, as I was working in a financial services and regulated marketplace, and then I saw the brave new world of startups, so people moving fast, doing interesting things, always curious about learning high performing, how do you build high performing teams and high performing engineering culture, and was really jealous, kind of gleaning to the outside world, seeing what's happening. Yeah,
we're gonna still drill down a little bit on that because it's always something. But you just like you said, like, you know, coming into the startup world from a different world and now going back into this, like, what was it like? Like, I'm sure there are things that startups do well that bigger institutions don't. I'm sure there are things. Let me put it this way: there's things that I think each can potentially learn from the other. I don't have the perspective of a big institution you do.
Yes.
So I'm super curious to know, like, if you contrast your LearnVest time with NM time or with your KKR time.
Yeah.
So what were some of the like wow moments for you? And like, just like, what advice can you pass on to?
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. I actually, this is my favorite subject, I think, because I had to think at our age in our lives, we kind of have to think like, what are we good at, or what do we want to do? What are we doing in life?
Exactly.
You know, I loved my experience in startups, and I am confident that I will probably go back to a startup life, and hopefully with you, Rishi, we'll work on that.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Yes. I love that, and I definitely will go back to that, and I miss that. But there is something also incredibly empowering when you go to these big institutions. So sometimes that are so mature, there's a little bit of hubris. You know, we've got here. You know, we're the big guys.
That's natural, I guess.
Yes. And there's something incredibly empowering, and maybe a little bit subversive, in a sense where they actually know that they can learn from startups. They want our help. They want people who have done things differently, who can break glass, who can bring that agile mindset, because it's very hard for a traditional company that's been doing things certain way to pivot in that kind of agile engineering mindset.
There's some inertia that's built in over the years. And,
absolutely. You know, bureaucratic drag, you name it, lack of talent, lack of this type of experience. So, and I think it's clear that these days, the world is run by engineers, to be honest. Finally, the geeks have won.
You knew it was going to happen one day.
Yes. And, you know, if you look at the companies that are performing the best, these are basically digitally native companies or companies that have evolved and done well evolving into technology companies. Yeah. And again, there's something incredibly empowering by going into these large bulge bracket institutions and actually teaching them how to do things differently. And there's definitely a lot of curiosity, and there's a lot of humility. Absolutely.
That's great.
Absolutely, actually.
Let me flip it around, like, what can we learn from big institutions?
Yeah, no, oh, that there's also that. Absolutely. And I, you know, to me, you know, What the big institutions do well is they already have an established client base, mm-hmm. but what they need to do is protect their license to operate.
Right.
Often the startups don't have that license, so it's okay mm-hmm. to move fast and break things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's what allows you to innovate and create new things, but sometimes you also take an unnecessary risk, right? I think the larger companies, because they have a lot to lose, mm-hmm. they're much more thoughtful and careful about risk awareness and compliance and kind of regulatory data privacy aspects right. of things. That's, of course, an important point.
And that's actually an area that, frankly, we are part of my group,
yes.
Osred, who, of course, yes. you know, a big part of what we're doing this year is actually that part
bringing
of it. So we are obviously still a startup, a high growth startup, but we are, I would say, in our, I guess, post-adolescence, early yes. adulthood stage, which
yes.
basically means that the things that the KKRs and the NMs
yes.
and the JP Morgans
yes.
of the world have nailed down and mastered
yeah.
is around exactly those things like risk and how do you innovate without imperiling?
Yes.
Because we, at the end of the day, we are a regulated.
You're
industry.
Also fiduciary, right? You have fiduciary responsibility.
Exactly. So, and we look to bigger institutions to yes. see how they do. And then we figure out did you see yourself doing that a little bit? So we figure out we probably don't need to do something at the scale of a KKR,
yes.
but
yes.
we should at least do X.
Yes.
And that X itself is sort of
yes.
a moving target as we
yes.
grow as a startup. What was I always try to imagine, because I left LearnVest right around the time that the acquisition
yeah.
happened. So I never really got to experience
yes.
life on the other
yes.
side of people.
Yes.
What was
yes.
that transition like for you?
Again, I found it exhilarating and exciting
yeah.
to me because, of course, people are scared. Definitely my teams were scared. Maybe some of them thought we sold out and
yeah.
of course, natural reaction.
It's just, yeah.
But I think to me, again, taking what we've done at a tiny scale
and
using that money and that funding to scale that to millions of users
yeah.
under the umbrella of a well-known established brand
yeah.
is incredible. And there's, again, going back to in startups, we're great at from the outset at often being technology companies, hopefully,
yeah.
if a startup set up correctly and if it's a technology-based startup, we're very good at kind of setting the right culture, building the right engineering culture.
Mm-hmm.
Engineers are often part of, technology is often part of the business and the business is technology.
Yeah.
Right. Netflix is a product and a product is a technology, right?
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
and that means that basically engineers are not in the backseat. They're not a cost center. They're not second rate citizens.
They are
equal partners. They are revenue producers.
Right.
They are having the front seat at the company, which is very, very critical for us.
And it's empowering too.
Very empowering. Motivating,
mm-hmm.
right? It's easy to retain people this way. When you look back at the big boys and all of us know the history, technology is expensive.
Yeah.
It's very, very hard. We talk in private equity notion of a J curve that
mm-hmm.
there's a thing that you first lose money
yep.
before you start making
you
money
up,
on your fund. And similarly in technology, technology investment has a J curve.
Yeah.
And not everyone is very comfortable with that. As a result, because we're always in large publicly traded corporations care about the bottom line, at least
yeah.
in the short term, that means that technology often is viewed as a cost center. Engineers are often service providers or kind of order takers,
yeah.
right? They're not considered, even that whole notion of front office and back office, there are haves and have-nots,
right.
Upstairs, downstairs, definitely engineers were downstairs in the basement somewhere. We've all seen locked,
Yeah, I remember Office Space.
Yeah. That's right, or IT Crowd. So, but I think there's this now awakening, of course. The world is becoming one big, huge digital reality.
Yeah.
The companies that have engineers at the helm are mm-hmm. taking over the world. You know, the companies that understand technology, that get digital, that get engineering culture are definitely the winners. And there's that recognition on the part of traditional companies that they have to
actually change. Yeah.
Yes. And I think it's nice to be in demand and to be in need. Because that's how I felt post LearnVest, is that I had an opportunity to help them.
And it's amazing. So I mean, I've heard obviously stories of that digital transformation at NM, and I'm guessing that you were able to kind of instill and foment's probably the wrong word, but like, you know, accelerate that change at KKR as well. Like, because I always think about it from a hiring standpoint as well. You're trying to grow an engineering team.
Yes.
And hiring is like finding good talent,
very, very
good
hard.
/ affordable talent.
Yes.
It's just tough in general, especially in a place like New York or in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But the challenges are different. Like for us, we can sell the excitement of, and honestly talk about the excitement of the things that you'd mentioned, like the engineering culture, and like we're on the bleeding edge. We're always open to new things. We're not locked into WebLogic or DB2 type stuff.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we can't, you know, but you'll probably get much better pay packages from a JP or, you know, and you probably have slightly different kind of challenge where you can obviously pay really well. But let me ask you as a question,
please.
Like, you know, how easy or not has it been to kind of attract talent on the merit of the tech at a place like KKR or NM for that matter, as opposed to just, you know, handsome.
It's never easy. I'll tell you that much. And I think digital transformation, you know, taking sort of traditional companies with a little bit of a legacy culture, legacy mindset, legacy technology into the digital future, it's not an easy thing. Actually very interesting thing. And I love to think about it and geek out on this. One of my ideas, by the way, to write a book with you, Rishi, is the title of the book, please nobody steal this, is Your Next CEO Should Be Your CTO. And I'll explain why.
please do.
You know, I do think it starts with the leadership and with culture. And, you know, in my journey at Northwestern Mutual, you know, we've had engineers who are, by the way, I absolutely loved my Midwestern engineers.
Yeah.
You know, talent is talent everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. But there's a lot of humility. There's a lot of loyalty.
Not too many tech boys.
No. And I learned a lot about Midwest. There's a lot of kind of interesting, I think, engineering mindsets. There's in the middle of our country, there's a lot of manufacturing roots, right? If I look at Wisconsin, I had no idea. You know, Trek bikes are made there. Kohler, you know, plumbing supplies are made there. Harley Davidson is made there. Like, there's just, you think about all these manufacturing engineering roots that that region has, and it has an amazing amount of engineers. But they were literally, as I mentioned to you, like kind of locked in the basement, and the keys were thrown out.
And you brought them.
Yes,
up.
the keys were thrown out, and they were locked in the basement with their mainframe IBM mainframes, and that the company promised to replatform for like the last 40 years and just never got around this because it was too expensive. And by the way, a lot of stuff got outsourced offshore to the lowest bidder. And knowing how expensive and how competitive technology talent is worldwide, not just, and especially in India, where now you have shops like Apple and Netflix, every major company is having its own captive
straight up offices. Yeah.
So you basically end up with the low, you know, leftovers if you really are going with a kind of traditional offshoring model.
Right.
So that was kind of the state of things. And, you know, just listening to people and making the engineers feel like they're counted, they mattered, and identifying top talent and elevating them above like layers and layers and layers of middle management who were just pushing paper and telling them they were basically working off of the backs of the couple of brilliant engineers in the basement. You know, that already went a long way.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Were you able to bring a lot of those kind of like learnings to KKR as well? And I do want to talk a little bit about the tech itself.
Absolutely.
It, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, would love to. And KKR was a little bit different situation. It's amazing. I do have to say, you know, Northwestern Mutual is a 160-year-old company. It was literally was actually quite innovative in technology in the 60s, where they were the first company to actually leverage IBM's big brain mainframe computer.
See, like, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, it was wheeled in, and there are like historical pictures in their museum. It's pretty amazing. So there's again these sort of like engineering roots existed there, but they kind of withered over the years of cost cutting.
Yeah.
Right. At KKR, a little bit of a different, you know, context here. I guess we're a 47-year-old company.
Younger.
Yes. We basically, our founders started the industry. They were the pioneers.
Yeah.
Henry and George. And
I knew.
Very cool. Very cool. And what's amazing is they are very proud. And what surprised me as I joined KKR, it's such a big name, but actually inside they're very small. They're only 1,500 people. They're actually, I think, the smallest company, like the number one company that generates revenue per head, because it's incredibly small, but very mighty.
Yeah.
And small and mighty because it has incredibly brilliant talent and cream of the crop business talent.
Across the board. Yeah.
Yes. And
so do we, by the way.
Oh, I know you do. That's why you're here. And so very, you know, very entrepreneurial still,
right.
You know, although again, like almost 50 years old company, definitely has some legacy. We, you know, are, it's also, as you probably aware, it's a very long running business. It's a business that runs in very long-term horizons,
right.
Which is not a very easy thing for us engineers to understand because we like to learn new technologies
all
every
time,
couple of days
yeah.
and we like to switch up, you know, contexts every couple of days. But going back to technology and kind of state of affairs of technology at KKR, I have to say I was surprised in general as I got to know not only KKR, but larger ecosystem of private equity.
Right.
And met a lot of colleagues who are in similar roles across the board in very large private equity shops, right. Is that the industry is pretty behind the curve when it comes to technology. Actually, even probably further away than insurance industry,
really?
Strangely, yes. And I had to understand why that's the case. And as I kind of started talking and learning about the industry, what became clear is that if you think about it, in its classic form, private equity, you know, you have a 12-year running fund and you're buying like one company every couple of years. So it's not a highly transactional business.
Right.
You know, the reason banks ended up with big back offices and technology enablement because they had to process
volume,
massive volumes. There was just no way around that. The same thing with hedge funds, right? The same thing with quant shops. In private equity, your advantage is your brilliant business mind, your Excel model, and your relationships. And you can do that for a very, 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 very long time. And by the way, in terms of even servicing your clients, the universe, the traditional universe of clients is no more than 1,000 clients. You know, you can communicate and engage with them manually all day long, high touch. And by the way, they prefer high touch. They don't want, you know,
they need the white glove. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. But fast forward to today, just like everything in America, there's massive amount of growth.
Yeah.
There's enormous amount of money pouring into that industry. And the industry is now pivoting away from kind of vanilla private equity. And specifically in KKR, in the last 10 years, KKR added an insane amount of new businesses, seeded new businesses, you know, real estate credit, leveraged credit, real assets, early technology investment, healthcare growth, infrastructure, you name it. So it's not just vanilla private equity. And additionally, we're also not only going to traditional LPs, which were large sovereign and probably public funds, but now retail. And that's where you guys come in.
That's where we
can learn a lot of stuff from you.
That's the segue. So and that's the thing. Like, you know, I think the thing that I'm always curious about. So our mission is to take these worlds of private credit and private equity and these kind of like space of opportunities and make them increasingly available or available to an increasingly broad audience, right? So we introduced the dimension of scale.
Yes.
So if we were to, like, you know, as you go down, let's say, this path of growing your audience, like even at KKR, and you say, okay, well, like the data center thing is not going to work anymore. Yes. We need to move to cloud, which you probably already have. What is the level of, like, selling that you think you would need to do unless you already done it?
So, this is a great question. I want to tell you, first of all, what level of selling, but also, you know, where we're going, I think, because I would like to exchange notes. First of all, again, I think the reason I ended up there was not because I was looking, it's because our founders, who, what amazes me at this firm is there, it continuously reinvents itself. It stays incredibly nimble. And I notice in the office of founder Henry Kravis, there is a plaque that says arrogance kills. And there's definitely this humility about we can learn from the world, you know, we can get better. Let's continuously get better at things. And so I was brought in with exactly that mandate. We are a world-class blue chip private equity shop. We want to become a world-class engineering organization. In some way, you know, they could have gone with a more traditional profile of a leader, you know, from another private equity or large, like Goldman or other places. Mm-hmm. They actually wanted someone with a startup experience, with technology experience, with hands-on engineering experience. And I give them, again, credit for that and not going the traditional way, because they do, you know, the vision is, again, we want to be a world-class engineering organization. And we want to be kind of known when people look at KKR, not just as a blue chip private equity shop, but also a blue chip technology platform.
That's, and I think one of the things that we've talked about in the past as well is how can we, like, the tech forward startups like Wall Street, and there's a number of them, most of whom I respect, like, and respect a lot, and the bigger shops. How can we, if we kind of rally around this mission, which was the founding mission for and continues to be the core value of Wall Street, which is investor first and democratizing this access, how can we work together, not just at a, you know, partnership level in the sense of, like, you know, working with, I believe at some point we are working together, but also at a technological level, like, how can we, let's say your tech team and my tech team here.
I would love that. Again, as I mentioned, to me, we have so much to learn. KKR and larger traditional financial services firms and private equity firms, especially from technology industry in general, from cloud native, digital and native companies in particular, for companies that are consumer and client centric. And just to kind of explain, you know, we didn't have what we're bringing and what I am bringing is sort of client centric or experience centric view. You know,
that's amazing.
Again, as in legacy, You hack something together, it sort of works. You throw it over the wall and someone is doing stuff on it, right? Yeah. But having learned from being in startups and spending so much time and making sure you create sticky, compelling experiences and how critical that
and
is.
And the process of building it too, where you have all of these perspectives around the same table designing this, whether it's designers, the data engineers, the front-end engineers, the back-end engineers, the stakeholders, like the product people, and, like, you're studying what works, what doesn't, and going back and forth instead of, like you said, the over-the-wall or assembly line kind of process, which just doesn't work,
you know,
regardless of whether you're a startup. And in many ways, I feel that does a disservice to the organization because you're not leveraging your talent to the extent that you can. Like, engineers, like, the idea that engineers are not qualified to participate in a design thing. It's just like, and this is not just about engineers. It's like in a many different, like, everyone can, because we are, at the end of the day, when you're building a consumer or retail platform, we are all one thing, regardless of our own competency, we all share is we are all consumers of that service itself. So we know what we like and what we don't like, and you can bring that to the table, and we have the added advantage of knowing how to fix it, you know? So
No, I can talk about this for hours. I know. I mean, it's just so...
We'll have to do a follow-on session of our chat at some point.
Totally. But I can say that, you know, again, bringing this perspective that startups have that often traditional companies don't have,
right?
Client-centric perspective, experience-led perspective, design thinking, that just was not a muscle that financial services companies had. But the reality is, you know, all of us, including our traditional LPs, mm-hmm. wake up in the morning and are surrounded by delightful client experiences in their consumer lives. Yeah. And then they turn around and go back to work and they're dealing with email and interfaces from 1990 and, you know, blue screens of death. That's not what we want, right?
So we're going to expect a nice, shiny mobile app from KKR soon, I guess.
I hope so. Definitely.
No, I mean, there's one other thing that, you know, so obviously like building compelling and engaging experiences is one of the key elements of building a good retail audience focused piece of software. There is a world, especially in fintech, in our worlds, like of software that we need to build to help our internal teams serve those audiences well. Now, I know in traditional shops, a lot of the tech energy is spent in building or buying slash building slash integrating with them. Do you see a future where we actually have nice, well-designed open systems for back office? Now, there are bulky applications that do specific things, but like one of the things we always struggle with because of kind of like the diverse nature of, I'm sure you will work with this, there is not a single system that you, so when we run into the buy, rebuild challenge, we're always thinking, how many ways can we tweak this?
Absolutely. No, I thought a lot about this. And I have to say, you know, the fun part about kind of getting new jobs and getting exposed to different industries, or you're always faced with new problems to solve, which is fascinating. I thought, oh, in my 20 years, I've seen it all. No, I have not seen it all.
Barely
scratched the surface. And one of the things that fascinate me in this industry is how much kind of manual. I even said, like, if I have a band, I'm going to call it spreadsheets and email. I don't know if it's original.
Or the spreadsheets.
Yeah. Or just spreadsheets.
Or the macros.
Yes. So how much of like back office stuff, like all the magic happens basically in email handoffs and spreadsheets, right? That's sort of like our worst nightmare, because there's no way to track or keep track or log errors or issues. You don't know if you made a mistake because spreadsheet cannot do that. There's no way to roll back. There's no workflow. Yes.
By the way, the pivot tables, that's a good name.
Yes. Oh, I like that. Totally. And so what I found, which was also fairly new thing to me, and I initially resisted that and I resisted it quite a bit, is there's now quite a bit of like low code and no code platforms. And, you know, as an engineer at heart, thought, you know, why use a proprietary platform that does some magic for you, that you end up with a cluster of a code on the back end? You know, why can't I build some elegant software and blah, blah, blah?
Yeah, I mean, it's taking the best part of being a software engineer out, which is writing software. You
know? Right. But I've definitely gone a full circle on this. You know, I think to me, I actually view low code, no code. It's sort of like a DevOps. To me, it's kind of like an analogous to DevOps and an infrastructure and kind of deployment side of things. It's basically what it forces you to do, not focus on exactly on how to build the software, but it focuses you to automate and rethink your processes.
That's a very good point.
Yes. Yeah. So that's the way for you to very quickly automate and clean up and streamline your processes. So your focus is not like building code. Your focus is, let's look at this insane process, which, by the way, all of these processes are insane.
Yeah.
Like, there's just so many. And how do I simplify it first? Yeah. And how do I make it more elegant? And how do I automate it?
Right, because you need to go through that decomplexifying process to be able to use a tool like it. So I'm guessing you're using some low code and no code stuff.
Yes, we do. And by the way, there's also what's fascinating is like the industry is moving in that direction
hugely. I'm finding out, you know, we're also, KKR is also investors in some of those systems, but I'm finding out even companies that didn't have the workflow automation as part of their initial offering is now offering that. So like Office 365 ecosystem, Power Tools. It's basically workflow automation platform. Super easy, very elegant. SharePoint is part of this, has gone a long way. I cannot believe I'm actually singing praises to SharePoint.
Yeah, we
would have killed me.
Like,
yes, we will talk about it.
I need a militant anti Microsoft environment.
Yes, like, Microsoft has come a long way.
The Edge has come a big way.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite browsers now.
Wow,
I never thought
dude.
I'd say that.
See? Never say never. You know, tools like Box now. Box, I actually met recently with the CEO of Box. Their whole new thing is now actually leveraging the no-code, low-code stuff on top of Box. Because think about it. You have the documents, right? And there's a lot of workflow around those documents.
So you can actually...
They're actually offering that.
Like,
and there's some really...
Yes. Wow.
So
I guess I got to look into that too. I'm always kind of like, as an engineer, I'm
when I come to you to
idea.
See some cool kick-ass stuff,
yeah,
I'm going
to
come and show you my low code stuff, dude.
Yeah, I got to see that. Well, we'll definitely hang out
totally.
At your office one day. So one of the questions that actually came in from one of our internal, from Joe over here. So we've both been fintech CTOs, CTOs. And we are also consumers of the services that we've built, right? You know, whether it's Yield Street or other platforms.
Yes.
How does being a fintech CTO influence your experience as an investor in these platforms, as user of these platforms? Put differently, like if someone showed you a new, hey, check this new thing out, it's a new platform that allows you to invest in X in a simple way. What are the things from a tech standpoint that would go through your mind before you decide to influence your decision as to whether to invest in that platform or not?
That's a great question. Again, I think it goes back to as a CTO and fintech CTO, but also from a traditional point of view, I think delightful client experience is very, very, very important.
So they care
and we still,
about,
I, yes, yes. And again, for our industry where we are, we have ways to go. There's a lot of reasons, of course, why and what, but I think that's definitely important. But there's also a realization that not everything can be turned into an algorithm.
Yeah, very true.
You know, there's always desire for us to just, you know, get and code stuff away and automate stuff away. But there's definitely, in our business, you don't get these types of return without the art of investing minds and what they're doing.
For sure, yeah.
And
so you look at their teams, you see what their pedigrees are.
That's a very
good point. I look at their tech stack too. So they're written in PHP. Sorry, no, can't do.
Right, that's a good one.
I'm just kidding. But that's actually true. Like, you know, I actually find myself doing a little bit. If I'm going to inspect the HTTP request headers to see if they have like a little Cloudflare beacon over there. Do they have perimeter security?
Yes.
Are their
very
APIs
good.
Protected?
Oh, absolutely.
So ViewSource is my favorite tool for any, it's not just about
that's
investing.
Brilliant.
It's about any
and
web
I agree
service.
Also about, if we're talking about this, I think security and how people talk about security and you and I have been in a lot of calls, you know, either, you know, in M&A calls or people buying companies or us selling companies,
the
you
due
know, those are fun, right? But you can see who's BSing you for sure. I like those questions.
Yeah, we went through a bit of that not too long ago as part of our Series C as well.
Oh, exciting.
That was a fun due diligence. It's actually a lot of fun to do that due diligence.
Yeah.
And if I can say so myself, like, you know, my team has built some very kind of state-of-the-art system.
That's awesome.
I'm going to show it to you in just a few minutes, but it's actually an interesting thing because when you understand the technology, it actually informs and sometimes can be a detriment because you're overthinking things.
Yes.
You know, it's like a
yes, I'm sure there's,
here.
Yeah, no, I agree. I probably could not be an investor because I think too much about technology, but I guess investment takes into account personalities and track record and what else, probably not exactly the quality of your code, but I do have to say that's important.
Let me just do a quick time check here. We are coming up on time. I'll just like kind of round off with, what do you have on the on your burner? Docket that's exciting for you to build at KKR?
Yeah.
To the extent that you can share.
Absolutely. I think the big one is almost predictable is data. We
have a big data team now.
Big data team. And by the way, remember our conversation a year ago and you giving me advice, Emilia, you can hire anyone. You're KKR. Just
that's
get
true.
That going.
You know,
well,
you
I did hire.
Awesome.
I followed your advice and I got a world-class head of data and analytics.
That's amazing.
Yes. And we've got... everyone on my team is a hands-on engineer first and a leader and a visionary second, or both, of course, at the same time. So we now have a world-class kind of cloud-native data engineering ecosystem that aggregates, and by the way, that has all of the sort of metadata, you know, access controls, our back, all designed from the outset, which is great. So like all the security controls and how you know, sort of document the data is there. And we're starting to see some fruits of that. I cannot wait to show our leadership, our people, you know.
So the insights. And
The insights, and it's pretty amazing.
You
so
may just be the most tech-forward PE shop out there right now.
We've got some ways to go, but we definitely have bold aspirations.
That's amazing. Hey, listen, it was a blast to have you. It's always fun to chat, and we've obviously done this several times. We're doing it for our audience. I hope all of you guys...
Rishi, real quick, we do have a question.
We have questions. Let's see.
Yeah, we do have one question. So it came in from one of the listeners, and they say, some large institutions have gone down the road to build pseudo-technology organizations that speak the biz speak, but have little tech literacy.
Mm-hmm.
But end up becoming a layer between the biz and technology world. Are there pros and cons for such an organization? And what is the view on such a setup?
Thank you. That's a beautiful question.
Question.
Oh my God.
Uniquely positioned to answer that.
Yes.
So
wow. I live and breathe this question every day. You know, I think as engineers, I like to say, and maybe a little bit self-serving, you know, as engineers, we can be CEOs of companies. Mm-hmm. We can do other things, but not every CEO can be an engineer. So to be an engineer, I think not only you have to be incredibly technical and understand your craft, you also have to be a great communicator.
Yeah.
You also need to understand the business so well that you can actually translate this into zeros and ones, into a practical application of it.
Yeah.
So to be an engineer, it requires enormous amount of talent. It's not an easy thing. And, you know, to build systems and to build solutions through technology, it's not something that someone can just learn on the side or do it on their own. It takes years of refining, and it takes many years to build this deep functional expertise. And yes, historically, as we've seen, there was always temptation to manage technology.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen, Rishi, you've seen big product teams that insert themselves between business users and engineers,
yeah,
or even design teams or project management offices, you know.
Yeah.
All important organizations. And by the way, I've seen my engineers on their knees when they don't have a good project manager and how much they need one, right? But at the same time, the reason you end up with massive security breaches,
yeah,
the reason you end up with massive legacy debt with companies, large companies who cannot progress an inch in their client experience or anything innovative, because you've disintermediated engineers, mm-hmm, and demoralized your engineers and didn't put engineers at the driver's seat, in the partnership seat with your business. Disintermediating engineers from the business is the number one mistake you can make to really put yourself make yourself like Kodak that went out of business. Maybe some story there happened, something like this. So I feel very strongly about that.
I guess as the TLDR is, no, that's not a model that'll ever work. If you want to be engineering forward, be serious about it and actually have real engineers who know how to do and empower them, and then sit back and
let them drive.
Any more questions for us?
We got one more. It is for Amelia. Amelia, great to listen to you today. How long do you think would be the typical sales cycle for KKR software / tech products? What do you expect will be the biggest challenge to face in introducing your future products to the public?
Wow. We have a little bit of a, maybe a different perspective. We have a ton of clients because we have a recognized name.
Right.
I think our challenge is actually not getting the clients or getting the sale done. Is our client, our challenge is getting the technology done.
Built.
We have a little bit of a reverse challenge. I know you guys have plenty of technology and sometimes probably struggle to get the clients, you know, and the reason why, you know, why it's harder for more traditional companies to move faster is, again, lots of legacy, yeah, you know, lots of ways we've already done things before, lots of complexity that you've accumulated over the years. And so that nimbleness that comes from the opportunity of building things greenfield,
yeah,
and launching them is not there. So that's our biggest challenge. But we are also trying not to kind of take ourselves down by not being able to move as fast. We like to kind of focus on small deliverables, mm-hmm, and iterate and show some value.
Agile.
Totally. Yeah. That's the way to go.
Awesome. Thanks for the questions.
Amelia, why don't you tell everybody where they could find you and KKR and get, yeah, any other information they would need?
Absolutely. I'm on Twitter. Not super active. And I'm on LinkedIn. I definitely very active on LinkedIn. Yes. So please find me, Amelia Sharifova, and ping me. I would love to talk to everyone.
And Rishi, what about you?
Just like that. I'm not on Facebook, unfortunately, but I am on Twitter at, my handle is kind of strange. It's UQBAR_. Long story some other time. But, and I'm also on LinkedIn, of course, Rishi Dixit. And would love to hear from any and all of you. We're going to, if there are no more questions, we'll start wrapping up again. Thanks for joining us. This was our latest installment of the Tech Talk series on The Yield. Just to remind everyone, we have a number of offerings open currently on our platform at yieldstreet.com. So do check them out. And if you are an originator looking to raise some capital, we have a raise capital link. Actually, it's in the header or the footer or both probably now on our site. Do check it out and fill it out, or you can just email us at originations@yieldstreet.com and we will get back to you right away. Thanks again for joining in. Again, thank you, Amelia, for an amazing hour almost of chatting. And we look forward to seeing you here again soon.
Thank you. Thank you, Rishi.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.